Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books, written by Sean Houghton. Test 6. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear 3 different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear a speaker called Leanne lecturing on the application of robot technology in the classroom.
South Korea has been using robot technology in the classroom for some time now, and not without some degree of success. For instance, in elementary schools, bots have been used as teaching assistants, where they can help with things such as pronunciation. And they are more than just a novelty. Research suggests that kids respond positively to them, which motivates their desire to learn. The kids themselves don't take the bots too seriously, but this is precisely why they are surprisingly effective. There's no fear factor, and the children interact to a greater extent in English than they otherwise would, viewing interaction with the bot as a kind of game. There are also practical reasons why bots have been introduced at other levels of the education system. For instance, placing native speakers in schools in remote areas is highly impractical. Most prospective teachers don't have the appetite for such locations, preferring to be somewhere more stimulating and exciting. In such circumstances, bots have also been employed effectively. These bots are more interactive. Indeed, think of them not as bots at all, really, but as interfaces. The bots themselves contribute little or nothing. They act as merely a medium, and on their screen appears the face of a real teacher, communicating remotely. While there's no substitute for an authentic native speaker classroom presence, this is surely the next best thing, where having one is simply unfeasible. South Korea has been using robot technology in the classroom for some time now, and not without some degree of success. For instance, in elementary schools, bots have been used as teaching assistants, where they can help with things such as pronunciation. And they are more than just a novelty. Research suggests that kids respond positively to them, which motivates their desire to learn. The kids themselves don't take the bots too seriously, but this is precisely why they are surprisingly effective. There's no fear factor, and the children interact to a greater extent in English than they otherwise would, viewing interaction with the bot as a kind of game. There are also practical reasons why bots have been introduced at other levels of the education system. For instance, placing native speakers in schools in remote areas is highly impractical. Most prospective teachers don't have the appetite for such locations, preferring to be somewhere more stimulating and exciting. In such circumstances, bots have also been employed effectively. These bots are more interactive. Indeed, think of them not as bots at all, really, but as interfaces. The bots themselves contribute little or nothing. They act as merely a medium, and on their screen appears the face of a real teacher, communicating remotely. While there's no substitute for an authentic native speaker classroom presence, this is surely the next best thing, where having one is simply unfeasible.
Extract 2. You will hear a travel writer called Davina discussing a visit to Ireland on a radio program.
The Wild Atlantic Way, as it is officially known now, is one of the longest coastal routes in the world, designed for vehicular travel, not footfall. Since its official launch several years ago, it has garnered a lot of attention in travel publications. Joining me is travel writer Davina Wallace, who, having just completed the route, will give us her take on this west coast of Ireland gem. Davina, where has it been hiding all this time?
Well, it's not as if the route has only just come into being as such, of course, Jeremy. It is not purpose-built. The meandering, narrow roadways of the West Coast were there long before this crafty marketing rebrand. But what the Tourism Board has done by officially categorising the route is bring it to the attention of a mass audience.
And in your experience, does it live up to the hype, Davina?
It certainly is spectacular. Ireland's Wild West is already well known as such, so this didn't come as a revelation to me, though seeing its natural beauty in the flesh, it was even better than what I'd read about it. Curiously, though, the country's infamously unpredictable weather detracted not an ounce from my enjoyment of the journey. Indeed, I would go so far as to say it only made the adventure more adventuresome and pleasurable.
The Wild Atlantic Way, as it is officially known now, is one of the longest coastal routes in the world, designed for vehicular travel, not footfall. Since its official launch several years ago, it has garnered a lot of attention in travel publications. Joining me is travel writer Davina Wallace, who, having just completed the route, will give us her take on this west coast of Ireland gem. Davina, where has it been hiding all this time?
Well, it's not as if the route has only just come into being as such, of course, Jeremy. It is not purpose-built. The meandering, narrow roadways of the West Coast were there long before this crafty marketing rebrand. But what the Tourism Board has done by officially categorising the route is bring it to the attention of a mass audience.
And in your experience, does it live up to the hype, Davina?
It certainly is spectacular. Ireland's Wild West is already well known as such, so this didn't come as a revelation to me, though seeing its natural beauty in the flesh, it was even better than what I'd read about it. Curiously, though, the country's infamously unpredictable weather detracted not an ounce from my enjoyment of the journey. Indeed, I would go so far as to say it only made the adventure more adventuresome and pleasurable.
Extract 3. You will hear part of a radio talk on the subject of performance by a sports scientist called Jason.
Why do athletes train at high altitude? Well, there's some serious science behind it, as it happens. The air is thinner, as most of you probably know already, the higher up we climb. Training at high altitude does things to us physiologically that give a genuine competitive edge as a direct result. The effect is most pronounced above 2,500 meters. However, it is to some extent evident even 1,000 meters lower. Below that, however, there is little in the way of difference compared with training at sea level. Because there are fewer oxygen molecules per volume of air at altitude, every breath taken gives the muscles less of what they require, so the body has to work harder. This triggers a hormone called EPO to produce more red blood cells in order to help deliver more oxygen to the muscles. As a consequence of the increased red blood cell count, athletes have a higher capacity to deliver oxygen to the muscles, which translates into a noticeably improved performance. However, the effects are not indefinite. It is necessary to get the timing of altitude training just right, as they will largely wear off between 10 and 20 days later. There are, however, some people with a rare genetic disorder which sees them able to sustain lasting effects. Indeed, they don't even have to train at high altitude to achieve the desired results, as their bodies are permanently in a high-altitude state. The condition is called Chuvash polycythemia, and essentially it means that even at sea level, the increased red blood cell count is triggered. Why do athletes train at high altitude? Well, there's some serious science behind it, as it happens. The air is thinner, as most of you probably know already, the higher up we climb. Training at high altitude does things to us physiologically that give a genuine competitive edge as a direct result. The effect is most pronounced above 2,500 meters. However, it is to some extent evident even 1,000 meters lower. Below that, however, there is little in the way of difference compared with training at sea level. Because there are fewer oxygen molecules per volume of air at altitude, every breath taken gives the muscles less of what they require, so the body has to work harder. This triggers a hormone called EPO to produce more red blood cells in order to help deliver more oxygen to the muscles. As a consequence of the increased red blood cell count, athletes have a higher capacity to deliver oxygen to the muscles, which translates into a noticeably improved performance. However, the effects are not indefinite. It is necessary to get the timing of altitude training just right, as they will largely wear off between 10 and 20 days later. There are, however, some people with a rare genetic disorder which sees them able to sustain lasting effects. Indeed, they don't even have to train at high altitude to achieve the desired results, as their bodies are permanently in a high-altitude state. The condition is called Chuvash polycythemia, and essentially it means that even at sea level, the increased red blood cell count is triggered.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a financial expert called Alexandra Harrow talking about the influence of the mobile phone on the way people transfer money on a radio show. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Now I want to turn to a service which is little known here in the UK, but which is revolutionising the way business is conducted in certain parts of the world. The service I'm referring to is M-Pesa. Let's take a look at this M-Pesa revolution and how it is transforming the way money is circulated in some African economies and elsewhere. First of all, what is M-Pesa? It is simply a way of making money transfers and purchase or payment transactions via mobile. The story of this money via mobile concept first began in 2002 at a conference in Johannesburg on sustainable development. Present at the conference was the head of the UK's Department for International Development, who had a fund at his disposal to invest in a project that would help improve access to financial services. A lack of access to the banking system was a particular problem for millions of poor people living in Africa. How many would-be entrepreneurs were being denied their chance to contribute to the economy as a consequence, even if such people wanted only small loans, which they could afford to pay back?
In reality, they were too poor for the existing banking system to bother with. The loans would not have been profitable enough to make them worthwhile. Therefore, what was needed was a new system tailored to meet their needs, a source of financial services for entrepreneurs and small businesses lacking access to the traditional banking system. This new system would become known as microfinance, and mobile money transfer would soon play a big role in it. The Department for International Development, DFID, had already noted a rising trend in African countries whereby mobile phone customers were themselves developing a sort of currency, or quasi-currency, by transferring prepaid airtime to one another as a means of payment. It decided to try to take things one step further and create an official payment system modelled very similarly. To do this, it teamed up with the Vodafone network, with each partner committing $1 million in funding to the fledgling project. Although neither partner envisaged the system serving any purpose other than to repay small microfinance loans by SMS, users, however, had a different idea, and it was ordinary mobile phone customers in Kenya, where the project first started, that drove its development into something much more influential. They started using it to send money to one another as a means of payment for things other than loans, from everyday purchases to utility bills. Not only that, but they also found it incredibly convenient for sending money home from big cities where they worked to their families in remote villages. Within 8 months of launching, more than 1 million Kenyans had signed up to mobile money. Today, there are well over 20 million users and about 100 times as many M-Pesa kiosks as there are cash machines. In a country where cash used to be king, now mobile money does the talking. And the mobile money revolution has now spread to around two-thirds of all developing countries, though it has yet to be introduced or embraced in any sense in the developed world. However, that may yet happen because, in actuality, mobile money payment is a far simpler and quicker service than any existing banking app can offer. Why it has been embraced in the developing world so quickly is clear, though. Cash-driven economies have a lot of corruption. Introducing mobile money helped to tackle this and was an unexpected benefit of the service. For example, in Afghanistan, policemen only started to realise how much of their basic salary was being taken illegally by their superiors before being passed on to them, when they started to receive their payments by mobile instead of cash. The amount of money they received was shockingly more than what their superiors had been giving them. Meanwhile, back in Kenya, drivers there realised that traffic officers harassing them for bribes would not be so keen to accept them through the M-Pesa system, since such bribes were then trackable and could be used as evidence, so they stopped carrying cash altogether, and then the harassment petered out too. Another benefit of this trackability, of course, is the fact that it helps prevent tax evasion. If payments and income can be tracked, it becomes very difficult to avoid paying tax. It is incredible how such a simple idea could really revolutionise the whole concept of...
Now you will hear part two again.
Now I want to turn to a service which is little known here in the UK, but which is revolutionising the way business is conducted in certain parts of the world. The service I'm referring to is M-Pesa. Let's take a look at this M-Pesa revolution and how it is transforming the way money is circulated in some African economies and elsewhere. First of all, what is M-Pesa? It is simply a way of making money transfers and purchase or payment transactions via mobile. The story of this money via mobile concept first began in 2002 at a conference in Johannesburg on sustainable development. Present at the conference was the head of the UK's Department for International Development, who had a fund at his disposal to invest in a project that would help improve access to financial services. A lack of access to the banking system was a particular problem for millions of poor people living in Africa. How many would-be entrepreneurs were being denied their chance to contribute to the economy as a consequence? Even if such people wanted only small loans, which they could afford to pay back, in reality, they were too poor for the existing banking system to bother with. The loans would not have been profitable enough to make them worthwhile. Therefore, what was needed was a new system tailored to meet their needs. A source of financial services for entrepreneurs and small businesses lacking access to the traditional banking system. This new system would become known as microfinance, and mobile money transfer would soon play a big role in it. The Department for International Development, DFID, had already noted a rising trend in African countries whereby mobile phone customers were themselves developing a sort of currency, or quasi-currency, by transferring prepaid airtime to one another as a means of payment. It decided to try to take things one step further and create an official payment system modelled very similarly. To do this, it teamed up with the Vodafone network, with each partner committing $1 million in funding to the fledgling project. Although neither partner envisaged the system serving any purpose other than to repay small microfinance loans by SMS, users, however, had a different idea, and it was ordinary mobile phone customers in Kenya, where the project first started, that drove its development into something much more influential. They started using it to send money to one another as a means of payment for things other than loans, from everyday purchases to utility bills. Not only that, but they also found it incredibly convenient for sending money home from big cities where they worked to their families in remote villages. Within 8 months of launching, more than 1 million Kenyans had signed up to mobile money. Today, there are well over 20 million users and about 100 times as many M-Pesa kiosks as there are cash machines. In a country where cash used to be king, now mobile money does the talking. And the mobile money revolution has now spread to around two-thirds of all developing countries, though it has yet to be introduced or embraced in any sense in the developed world. However, that may yet happen because, in actuality, mobile money payment is a far simpler and quicker service than any existing banking app can offer. Why it has been embraced in the developing world so quickly is clear, though. Cash-driven economies have a lot of corruption. Introducing mobile money helped to tackle this and was an unexpected benefit of the service. For example, in Afghanistan, policemen only started to realise how much of their basic salary was being taken illegally by their superiors before being passed on to them, when they started to receive their payments by mobile instead of cash. The amount of money they received was shockingly more than what their superiors had been giving them. Meanwhile, back in Kenya, drivers there realised that traffic officers harassing them for bribes would not be so keen to accept them through the M-Pesa system, since such bribes were then trackable and could be used as evidence, so they stopped carrying cash altogether, and then the harassment petered out too. Another benefit of this trackability, of course, is the fact that it helps prevent tax evasion. If payments and income can be tracked, it becomes very difficult to avoid paying tax. It is incredible how such a simple idea could really revolutionise the whole concept of...
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio programme in which two people, Olivia Wilde and Michael Asimwe, are discussing the African tour company they work for. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
I'm joined today by the head of African Overland Tour Company Joy Adventures, Olivia Wild, and one of her veteran tour guides, Michael Azimwe, for this week's travel feature, in which we throw the spotlight on Africa, and in particular, land-based touring and adventures there. Olivia, turning first to you, can you tell me what an overland tour company offers that is so unique?
Certainly. Africa is, of course, a huge continent, so the logistical challenge of seeing much of it in one go is stern, to say the least. Usually, extensive travel comes at a price which affords it only to a privileged few. What we aim to do at our tour company is make Africa accessible and affordable to all. We offer overland itineraries which enable tourists to see many different parts of the continent, while keeping costs in check. This is one factor which differentiates us from other tour operators out there, and we pride ourselves on our inclusivity. We make Africa accessible to all.
But this sounds almost too good to be true. Otherwise, why don't all tour operators have the same model?
Well, let me explain. There is, of course, a trade-off for keeping costs low. We offer a no-frills experience. This is not the luxury African adventure most of your listeners will be accustomed to hearing about. It's quite hands-on. Tour members are expected to partake in cooking, cleaning, and pitching tents and so forth. It's all part of the experience. They're not waited on hand and foot. And by and large, the accommodation is basic, camping for the most part, as I mentioned, though there are occasional stops in large towns where we use dorm rooms, and upgrades are possible to private accommodation in most places where we stay for those prepared to pay a little extra from their own pocket who would like improved comfort.
I see. And what is your role, Michael? What does tour guiding on such a no-frills adventure entail?
Well, I have to be a bit of a jack-of-all-trades. I'm a driver, entertainer, guide and chef. Again, in order to offer the best value for money, it's necessary for us to keep staffing levels to a minimum. So there are seldom more than one or two guides accompanying each tour. We, if you like, oversee and manage things. And the tourists themselves also pitch in to bring everything together and make the experience as pleasant as possible, as Olivia already mentioned, I think. It is a very rewarding and fulfilling experience, and I use my local knowledge to make it even more so.
Indeed, Michael makes an important point. Our company is committed to using local staff and supporting the local community. This is another excellent reason to choose our packages. You are, essentially, giving something back to Africa for the wonderful experience you enjoy there. We source local produce for food and supplies where possible, only stay in accommodation owned and staffed by locals, and exploit the in-depth knowledge our guides have to provide a truly unique and unrivaled experience of Africa.
So, are you the only company offering such tours? You make your packages sound very unique indeed.
Well, that was so until recently, yes. However, copycats are emerging and trying to jump on the back of our success, having seen the great appetite amongst tourists for what we offer. But there's no substitute for the experience we have amassed from being in this business for 20-plus years. It's simply impossible to replicate what we offer, therefore, I believe.
I would agree with Olivia, having worked for a number of different tour operators. I can certainly vouch for the fact that Joy Adventures is the best. For instance, take the overland vehicles. Even these are tailor-made. While other tour operators use modified buses or trucks, we have designed, commissioned and produced one-off vehicles purpose-built for overlanding in Africa. They offer unrivaled practicality and comfort. It's another example of the lengths we go to ensure our offering is truly unique and value for money. The overland vehicles alone, of course, do not justify the choice of our tour, but they're one of the main key ingredients, which mean that it's truly unrivaled.
Michael is right. We leave the competition trailing, to be perfectly honest with you, and not just in terms of the experience, but also in terms of price.
Right, thank you. Now, let's look a little, shall we, at some of your specific itineraries.
Now you will hear part 3 again.
I'm joined today by the head of African Overland Tour Company Joy Adventures, Olivia Wild, and one of her veteran tour guides, Michael Azimwe, for this week's travel feature, in which we throw the spotlight on Africa, and in particular, land-based touring and adventures there. Olivia, turning first to you, can you tell me what an overland tour company offers that is so unique?
Certainly. Africa is, of course, a huge continent, so the logistical challenge of seeing much of it in one go is stern, to say the least. Usually, extensive travel comes at a price which affords it only to a privileged few. What we aim to do at our tour company is make Africa accessible and affordable to all. We offer overland itineraries which enable tourists to see many different parts of the continent, while keeping costs in check. This is one factor which differentiates us from other tour operators out there, and we pride ourselves on our inclusivity. We make Africa accessible to all.
But this sounds almost too good to be true. Otherwise, why don't all tour operators have the same model?
Well, let me explain. There is, of course, a trade-off for keeping costs low. We offer a no-frills experience. This is not the luxury African adventure most of your listeners will be accustomed to hearing about. It's quite hands-on. Tour members are expected to partake in cooking, cleaning, and pitching tents and so forth. It's all part of the experience. They're not waited on hand and foot. And by and large, the accommodation is basic, camping for the most part, as I mentioned, though there are occasional stops in large towns where we use dorm rooms, and upgrades are possible to private accommodation in most places where we stay for those prepared to pay a little extra from their own pocket who would like improved comfort.
I see. And what is your role, Michael? What does tour guiding on such a no-frills adventure entail?
Well, I have to be a bit of a jack-of-all-trades. I'm a driver, entertainer, guide and chef. Again, in order to offer the best value for money, it's necessary for us to keep staffing levels to a minimum. So there are seldom more than one or two guides accompanying each tour. We, if you like, oversee and manage things. And the tourists themselves also pitch in to bring everything together and make the experience as pleasant as possible, as Olivia already mentioned, I think. It is a very rewarding and fulfilling experience, and I use my local knowledge to make it even more so.
Indeed, Michael makes an important point. Our company is committed to using local staff and supporting the local community. This is another excellent reason to choose our packages. You are, essentially, giving something back to Africa for the wonderful experience you enjoy there. We source local produce for food and supplies where possible, only stay in accommodation owned and staffed by locals, and exploit the in-depth knowledge our guides have to provide a truly unique and unrivaled experience of Africa.
So, are you the only company offering such tours? You make your packages sound very unique indeed.
Well, that was so until recently, yes. However, copycats are emerging and trying to jump on the back of our success, having seen the great appetite amongst tourists for what we offer. But there's no substitute for the experience we have amassed from being in this business for 20-plus years. It's simply impossible to replicate what we offer, therefore, I believe.
I would agree with Olivia, having worked for a number of different tour operators. I can certainly vouch for the fact that Joy Adventures is the best. For instance, take the overland vehicles. Even these are tailor-made. While other tour operators use modified buses or trucks, we have designed, commissioned and produced one-off vehicles purpose-built for overlanding in Africa. They offer unrivaled practicality and comfort. It's another example of the lengths we go to ensure our offering is truly unique and value for money. The overland vehicles alone, of course, do not justify the choice of our tour, but they're one of the main key ingredients, which mean that it's truly unrivaled.
Michael is right. We leave the competition trailing, to be perfectly honest with you. And not just in terms of the experience, but also in terms of price.
Right, thank you. Now, let's look a little, shall we, at some of your specific itineraries.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which people talk about their study abroad programs. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H the main reason each speaker originally wanted to study in a foreign country. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H how each speaker now feels about their time abroad. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
I wanted to study abroad mainly because when you come from a small place, like I do, it can get quite suffocating after a while. Of course, while being a foreign student is not as cost prohibitive as it once was, I wouldn't regard it as cheap either. So it was a major undertaking to finance my studies in this way. However, I felt it would be worth it, and luckily my parents agreed to help out when I couldn't get a scholarship. And time has proven me correct, because once I overcame the initial sense of anxiety that accompanies homesickness, I never looked back. My time in Australia's most populous city was life-changing in the best way possible. Indeed, speaking of looking back, on reflection, my overriding sense is one of deep gratitude. It was such a privilege to be afforded this opportunity.
Speaker 2.
My family couldn't afford to support me through third-level education, so I scoured the net, hoping to find a solution myself. That's when I chanced upon a bursary offered by a wealthy British expat to any fellow Brit willing to come and study at his old university, UBC in Vancouver, Canada. The only condition maintaining financial support was that I had to pass all my exams first time, no resets. The offer sounded almost too good to be true. Unlike the scholarships I didn't qualify for, the only thing that mattered was nationality, which I satisfied being a Manchester Brit. Once I received the bursary, I applied myself intently and studied incredibly hard. Reflecting now on my time there, I only lament the fact that I didn't allow myself to enjoy the experience more. I was so focused on my academic performance that I never stopped to appreciate Vancouver itself until it was too late.
Speaker 3.
I told my parents that the reason I wanted to study abroad was to improve my language skills, which was sort of a white lie because while I do love languages, I really craved greater independence more than anything. Anyway, they bought into my argument and even offered to finance my studies, though that was unnecessary as I had already been offered a scholarship on account of my golf handicap. Quebec was memorable for many reasons, but casting my mind back now, perhaps with hindsight, I ought to have chosen an area where English is less widely spoken. Had I been reliant on my second language, I believe my fluency would have progressed more. In that sense, it was a missed opportunity. But I wouldn't change a thing about the place itself or my experiences there, which were out of this world.
Speaker 4.
I'm 1/3 Native American, yet this factored in very little to my decision to study in Saskatchewan. Simply, I had always wanted to visit North America and take in all the famous tourist sites, and I was able to exploit my heritage to avail of a scholarship to go to university there. Otherwise, I could not have afforded to study abroad. By the end of my studies, however, I was a person transformed. I feel a strong sense of affiliation with the Aboriginal people now, and have great pride in this aspect of my background. I believe I would never have connected with my roots had it not been for the time I spent in Saskatchewan. Ironically, I spent very little time on the tourist circuit there at all, and regretted every minute that I did, because I was never so happy as when I was in Saskatchewan itself with the native people, learning about their and my culture.
Speaker 5.
My motivation for studying in Alberta, Canada, was very logical. I'm a fossil enthusiast, and what better place to study paleontology than in the region of the famed Dinosaur Provincial Park? There would be no need for long field trips when the subject of my research would be on my very doorstep the whole time. I was so sure of myself and how much I would love studying there that I was confidence personified on arrival. However, not all of us are suited to being far from home for an extended period, as I would soon find out. And my overriding recollection of my time there is not, as I'd hoped, the terrific opportunity it presented for my professional studies, but rather how isolated and far removed from the familiarity of home I was, and how much I looked forward to returning to same.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
I wanted to study abroad mainly because when you come from a small place, like I do, it can get quite suffocating after a while. Of course, while being a foreign student is not as cost prohibitive as it once was, I wouldn't regard it as cheap either. So it was a major undertaking to finance my studies in this way. However, I felt it would be worth it. And luckily, my parents agreed to help out when I couldn't get a scholarship. And time has proven me correct, because once I overcame the initial sense of anxiety that accompanies homesickness, I never looked back. My time in Australia's most populous city was life-changing in the best way possible. Indeed, speaking of looking back, on reflection, my overriding sense is one of deep gratitude. It was such a privilege to be afforded this opportunity.
Speaker 2.
My family couldn't afford to support me through third-level education, so I scoured the net, hoping to find a solution myself. That's when I chanced upon a bursary offered by a wealthy British expat to any fellow Brit willing to come and study at his old university, UBC in Vancouver, Canada. The only condition maintaining financial support was that I had to pass all my exams first time, no resets. The offer sounded almost too good to be true. Unlike the scholarships I didn't qualify for, the only thing that mattered was nationality, which I satisfied being a Manchester Brit. Once I received the bursary, I applied myself intently and studied incredibly hard. Reflecting now on my time there, I only lament the fact that I didn't allow myself to enjoy the experience more. I was so focused on my academic performance that I never stopped to appreciate Vancouver itself until it was too late.
Speaker 3.
I told my parents that the reason I wanted to study abroad was to improve my language skills, which was sort of a white lie because while I do love languages, I really craved greater independence more than anything. Anyway, they bought into my argument and even offered to finance my studies, though that was unnecessary as I had already been offered a scholarship on account of my golf handicap. Quebec was memorable for many reasons, but casting my mind back now, perhaps with hindsight, I ought to have chosen an area where English is less widely spoken. Had I been reliant on my second language, I believe my fluency would have progressed more. In that sense, it was a missed opportunity, but I wouldn't change a thing about the place itself or my experiences there, which were out of this world.
Speaker 4.
I'm one-third Native American, yet this factored in very little to my decision to study in Saskatchewan. Simply, I had always wanted to visit North America and take in all the famous tourist sites, and I was able to exploit my heritage to avail of a scholarship to go to university there. Otherwise, I could not have afforded to study abroad. By the end of my studies, however, I was a person transformed. I feel a strong sense of affiliation with the Aboriginal people now, and have great pride in this aspect of my background. I believe I would never have connected with my roots had it not been for the time I spent in Saskatchewan. Ironically, I spent very little time on the tourist circuit there at all, and regretted every minute that I did, because I was never so happy as when I was in Saskatchewan itself with the native people, learning about their and my culture.
Speaker 5.
My motivation for studying in Alberta, Canada, was very logical. I'm a fossil enthusiast, and what better place to study paleontology than in the region of the famed Dinosaur Provincial Park? There would be no need for long field trips when the subject of my research would be on my very doorstep the whole time. I was so sure of myself and how much I would love studying there that I was confidence personified on arrival. However, not all of us are suited to being far from home for an extended period, as I would soon find out. And my overriding recollection of my time there is not, as I'd hoped, the terrific opportunity it presented for my professional studies, but rather how isolated and far removed from the familiarity of home I was, and how much I looked forward to returning to same.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.